Small Town Podcast is made possible by generous support from the Georgia Municipal Association. GMA supports Georgia cities. Small Town Podcast is supported by Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company. Consolidated Pipe is a full-line supplier of products for the water, wastewater, and natural gas industries, and they serve utilities and public works departments in cities, large and small, every day. They're the exclusive distributor of Master Meter AMI-AMR technology. As a family-owned company with a legacy that began in 1960, let Consolidated Pipe show you that they are dedicated to service.
I hereby call this episode to order.
Hey, small towners, it's Mayor Matt Seal, and thanks for joining me for another episode of Small Town Podcast. Now, in this episode, instead of visiting a specific small town, we're going to revisit an issue that is affecting small towns and big cities all across the nation: infrastructure. That's water and sewer systems, roads and bridges, broadband, and more. Now, if you were listening to our podcast last year, you may remember the infrastructure episode where we spoke to several elected officials about their community's infrastructure needs, as well as experts in various infrastructure fields and policy experts at the federal level. Well, it's 1 year later, and this issue is still very much a priority for many community leaders. The Georgia Municipal Association recently held its annual convention, and infrastructure was a very hot topic again. I had the chance to speak to someone you may remember from last year's infrastructure episode to see what has happened in the last year and what still remains at stake. Growing up in coastal Georgia, I only thought I lived in a small town. As soon as I graduated high school, I moved to the big city of Atlanta for college and to start my life. My life is a journey, and I ended up in Ocilla, Georgia. Population 3,400. We've got two traffic lights here. We're not looking to get a third anytime soon. Some years later, the people of Ocilla made me their mayor. Man, I love living in a small town. Other folks do too. This is the Small Town Podcast, and I'm your host, Mayor Matt Seal of the great city of Ocilla, Georgia.
Becky Taylor, Director of Federal Relations and Research for GMA.
All right, Becky, it's been a year since we talked about infrastructure, and so we're back at convention. And so just give us kind of a recap of anything that's happened or maybe things that just haven't happened in the year since then regarding infrastructure specific to Georgia, but obviously this affects the whole country and towns everywhere.
Okay, so we talked last year at the convention about infrastructure needs across Georgia. GMA did a survey a couple of years ago, capital needs survey, to find out where cities need capital improvements and what categories of need they had. And we came up with the total projected need of $11.2 billion in categories like transportation, water and sewer, public safety. I think that the needs probably exceed what we projected. Definitely in the intervening years since we've done the survey and done those projections, I think that they're probably even more. Cities are doing what they can with what they've got. Some cities, I think, are probably deferring some of their maintenance that they need to be doing, and they aren't able to make some of the improvements that they had planned to do. So we're still trying to work with the federal government to get some attention on these matters and make sure that they know how important cities are, how important addressing these needs are, and how important it is that we have the federal government as a partner, because cities can't do it alone.
So there hasn't been an infrastructure bill per se, but what action or where have things gone at the federal level since last year when we had this talk?
There hasn't been a federal infrastructure bill. That has been something that Congress has talked about, the White House has talked about as a priority. Infrastructure funding is not Democrat or Republican. It is just a universal need that we have to address. But unfortunately, really, no traction has been made at the federal level yet. It's been discussed. They've also talked in Congress about reauthorizing the federal transportation bill, which is up for reauthorization next year, but they had planned to focus on it this year. Still not much action on that yet either. But definitely these are things that GMA and our Federal Policy Council and all of our city officials are continuing to work on and keep that message out there that we still need federal assistance with these programs.
So with that in mind, what advice would you give to local officials, whether they're in Georgia and other states or even, you know, everyday citizens, that obviously infrastructure and the dilapidation of the infrastructure affects our everyday lives? What would you suggest people do?
My suggestion for local officials, for citizens, anybody who understands how important this issue is, stay in touch with your congressman. Talk to your congressman about these issues. And I think especially important for small towns to reach out to their congressman because you have a very important story to tell. And let them know examples of projects in your communities. Take them to those sites and show them what's going on in your community. They remember those examples when they're trying to craft these pieces of legislation. It really helps them to have those hometown connections.
Thanks, Becky.
Thank you.
At this year's convention, Becky led the GMA-hosted Federal Policy Council meeting. There was a representative from a U.S. Senator's office, as well as someone from the White House. And just like last year, a presentation was made by someone from the National League of Cities. Last year, we heard from Brittany Kohler, who introduced us to the Rebuild With Us campaign to raise awareness in Congress about the increasing need for rebuilding America's infrastructure in a partnership between the local, state, and federal levels. This year, we heard from someone new, but the message remains very much the same.
I'm Angelina Panettiere. I'm Principal Associate for Technology and Communications at the National League of Cities.
So, Angelina, we just talked with the Federal Policy Council, and you gave a presentation and kind of gave us a little bit of, an update of where things are infrastructure-wise at the federal level with all cities across the nation. So just talk about that, the Rebuild With Us campaign. We actually learned about that last year from Brittany. So tell us where things are.
Sure. So at the Federal Policy Council meeting today, we really focused on infrastructure. And it was great to hear your speaker from Senator Perdue's office and your speaker from the White House both focus on infrastructure, because that continues to be one of the biggest issues for us. You mentioned that last year Brittany talked to you about the Rebuild With Us campaign, and we still have that going on this year. The same bundle of issues. Unfortunately, while we've made some progress on some areas like broadband and water, we still don't have a continuing transportation bill. We're still fighting for better financing options for cities, and we're still looking for more disaster recovery and resilience programs to be developed.
So what are some of the things that you're seeing? Because I mean, I focus a lot on Georgia because that's where I'm at, but across the nation, what are some of the things that just makes this such a severe problem with different infrastructure categories?
So I work on broadband, which is where I focus most of my time. And one of the things that has been both concerning and encouraging is the state of rural broadband. That's a particular issue in states like Georgia, where there's a large agricultural component of the economy. And a lot of agricultural businesses and small towns really rely on a broadband connection to remain economically viable, to compete with communities elsewhere in the country or internationally, especially when you're looking at agriculture. So we're seeing a bipartisan recognition that we don't know where broadband is, and we have to improve the way that we map broadband at a federal level. Currently, we map broadband at the census tract. So if anybody in your census tract is capable of subscribing to broadband, the federal government assumes everybody in that census tract has broadband. And we all know that once you start slicing it below that, that's not at all how it works. So there's a bunch of bills being introduced that would change how we map broadband, potentially down to the household or address level, so that we could tell who in a community or which properties have broadband access. But that's only part of the story. And unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of investment in large-scale broadband spending. We have some very encouraging starts. We have a pilot program that just launched at the U.S. Department of Agriculture called Reconnect that would plow hundreds of millions of dollars into rural broadband infrastructure. But we still need to look at areas that the USDA doesn't consider rural but are still underserved, a lot of suburbs and exurbs that aren't going to be represented by these rural programs or by programs that only address unserved communities.
So you kind of referenced this earlier, but give us kind of a status where things are with a big infrastructure bill or some of the progress that needs to happen at the federal level, at the congressional level.
Right. So for a big infrastructure bill, things have definitely slowed down. but I wouldn't say they've stopped. One of the things that is still moving on the congressional level is trying to put priorities from individual senators and representatives into a master infrastructure bill. We haven't seen anything introduced yet that would be that kind of large-scale infrastructure package. Everyone keeps telling us, both from the White House and in Congress, that they're still talking about it and still working on it, but it's hard to say where it is when we don't have language to respond to. And the timing on that is very important because right now it's June. August recess is coming up very soon, and once we get past August recess, we're going to be looking at funding the federal government and avoiding another shutdown. And then after that, it's 2020, and we're looking at elections for the president and for every member of the House and a third of the Senate, and not a lot gets done during an election year.
So that's all high-level stuff, but to a person listening to this who wants to know how they can get involved and get engaged, I know that NLC has some ways to do that, so talk about that for just a minute.
Yes, so there's lots of ways that you can get involved through NLC. I encourage everyone who's listening and participates in NLC to join one of our federal advocacy committees and sign up for our Federal Advocacy Update newsletter. We send that out once every 2 weeks, and that includes updates on what's happening on Capitol Hill, what's happening in federal agencies. We provide people with template letters and talking points that they can use to communicate with their members of Congress. We even put together instruction guides on how to comment on federal regulations. So no matter the size of your community and no matter how much experience you have in advocacy, the important thing is that you know what's happening in your neighborhood, and we can give you the tools to communicate that professionally and confidently to people in Washington.
And I think you've got a kind of a campaign. You're encouraging people to post on social media with a specific hashtag. Talk about that campaign.
Yes, our big non-policy campaign this year is being run by our president, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, Indiana. It's called Love My City. It started with the belief that every city, town, and village has something to love about it. And so we want city officials and residents to show how they love their city. People can find out more by visiting mycity.love, where we have lots of resources. You can create a custom logo that shows how you love your city, town, or village. And we're also encouraging people to post selfies and fun things on social media and hashtag them with hashtag love my city, and we'll pick those up and share them out. But this is the summer of love, and we want people to have events and just show everyone why they love their city.
Angelina, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Small Town Podcast is sponsored by Koch Industries. Just like the great small towns we feature on Small Town Podcast, every great company has a story. From its humble beginnings starting out in Middle America in the 1960s, Koch Industries has become one of the largest privately held companies in the nation and has achieved an international presence in 50 countries around the globe. The companies of Koch Industries create innovations in transportation, medical care, water filtration, building materials, household goods, and so many other products and technologies that impact our lives every day. You can see more of the Koch story, both where they've come from and where they're going, by visiting kochind.com/podcast. Small Town Podcast is supported by the Southern Mercantile. Visit southernmercantile.com for a blog about small town living and an online store with a selection of carefully curated goods. The Southern Mercantile. Simple living, Southern charm. Now, last year, we talked about things at a big picture level, speaking with Georgia Agriculture Commissioner Gary Black and Georgia Department of Transportation Director of Planning Jay Roberts. This time, I got into some conversations that focused more on things at the local level, especially the struggles of small towns. After all, this is Small Town Podcast. I decided to talk to people who work for companies who work with people at the local level and are very familiar with small town challenges in infrastructure. All right, I'm sitting here with Matt Floyd from Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company, who is a sponsor, a season sponsor of Small Town Podcast, and I thank him very much for that and his role in that. So, Matt, welcome to Small Town Podcast.
Good afternoon, Mayor Matt. Proud to be here.
We are talking about infrastructure. We did an episode, you remember, from last season about infrastructure, the importance of
federal funds, but then also we had an engineer on talking about that. So we're kind of talking about that a little more. But before we get into that, I like to get to know my guests a little bit. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? We're sitting here in Richmond Hill, Georgia, Bryan County, over in coastal Georgia. This is your old stomping grounds, right? Well, your current stomping grounds.
My current stomping grounds. Yes, sir. My family moved here in 1988. I was five.
And so you had no say in the matter.
I did not. No. I was brought along. We moved from Southern South Carolina to Richmond Hill, Georgia, which at the time was a small town.
Yep.
It was a crossroads.
Yeah.
And it's not anymore. It's a pretty large town, and it's been very successful. But so I grew up here, graduated high school here, bounced around a little bit in small jobs, and eventually found my way into a small private water company. And I worked there for some time, and I got involved in this industry and read meters and laying underground water and sewer line. Found my way to a role at Consolidated Pipe, and I've been there ever since.
Well, let's talk about Consolidated Pipe, because the city of Osceola has done business with them for a little while, and I was familiar with them from some GMA events and things that they were involved in. But I didn't realize until I kind of looked more and developed a business relationship with you guys just how big you guys are and I guess how far back it goes. So just give us a little history of the company, where it got started, and kind of what you guys do and how far spread you guys are geographically.
Sure. We enjoy, I think, at most every branch, sort of a small company feel and you know, branch-led decisions. But we were founded in 1960 in Birmingham, Alabama. We're a family-owned company. We're the second generation owns the company now, two brothers, and their two sons are now staged to take over the company. So it's been a very consistent focus, I think, through the years, even to today. We're in about 20 states. We have nearly 50 branches, maybe actually over 50 branches. Across our divisions of waterworks, we have we do a lot of steel for oil and gas, natural gas. We have a consolidated coatings division. We do very large coating jobs. We have a consolidated power, HDPE fittings and fabrication. We do a lot of that in Lawrenceville.
So there's actually a burning question that you need to answer for listeners of Small Town Podcast, because as you guys are a season sponsor, I make sure there's a mention.
Sure.
About you, a little bit about the company. And one of the phrases I use is about you guys being the sole provider of Master Meter AMR, AMI. Actually, I think I said that backwards. AMI, AMR? Which one is it?
I think that's how you said it.
AMR technology. I know what that is because we now have it in Osceola and have benefited greatly from it. But for people that don't know and aren't mayors of small towns, they had to learn that on their own. Give us a quick synopsis of what AMI, AMR technology is and what it does.
Sure. And we are the distributor for Master Meter in Georgia and a few other states. We have been since 2004. It's said a few different ways. I haven't looked it up in the dictionary necessarily, but
so I couldn't even remember how I was saying it for the spot for you now, so go
right.
ahead.
So AMI refers to automated metering infrastructure, automatic metering infrastructure. So that's typically a tower-based system where meters communicate generally daily with a cloud or with City Hall. So instead of, you know, actively driving around and reading your meters via drive-by, the readings are automatically uploaded to a cloud, so they're accessible at any time. AMR, automated meter reading, is generally a drive-by system, which is what City of Osceola has.
That's right.
Each meter transmits, you drive around the city in your truck and pick up the readings once a month or as often as you see fit.
And it sounds like from that the AMI is more expensive, which is why the city of Osceola has the AMR.
Yeah. There's a little extra cost, yes.
A little bit, but it's the cost benefit for us. Just I guess I'm putting in a plug here because it's saved us so many man hours every month, because we used to have a meter reader or one or two guys, and it would pretty much be about sometimes 50 or 60 man hours. Now you cut that in half by sending two guys out, but that's one more person that's not able to do anything else for utilities or public works in the city.
Right.
But also the information you're able mm-hmm. to get from that, because we're able to tell people when they have a potential leak. because the system will tell you if you had 24 hours straight that water ran through the meter. Well, that generally means you're either filling a swimming pool and it took 24 hours to do so, or you've got a leak somewhere or a running toilet or stuff like that. So the customer service we're able to provide for that's been good, and I'm sure your other customers are benefiting from that too. So all right, so now everyone knows what AMR technology is and why it's good for cities. Well, like I said, we're talking about infrastructure, just kind of bringing up this conversation again. And you have contact with so many different, not just cities, but certainly a lot of cities, small and big.
Sure.
And their utilities directors or public works directors. So your perspective, I think, is fairly unique because you have, you know, this, you can draw from a broad range of experiences. So speak to the importance of infrastructure and maybe how it seems to be overlooked. And I bet you'd have some examples of what happens when things get overlooked for a little too long. And you've dealt with some of those customers and probably helped them out a little bit here and there.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's obviously important. I deal with a lot of, you know, the focus of your podcast in small town Georgia and or small towns in general. I think from that perspective, you see it a little more firsthand because there's such a connection between the public works director or city manager and the infrastructure. There's not layer upon layer of help and labor assistance. So we see the strains of that small town public works director and how much they have to accomplish under, you know, oftentimes a pretty tough budget and not a lot of labor. So there's a lot of a reactive repair work instead of, you know, proactive replacement. I mean, in the last few years, we've seen a lot of replacement through CDBG and some other grant projects and some small towns that we do business with, and that's been a great influx of new infrastructure. You know, for an example, I know some stretches of water main that probably have more repair couplings than plastic at present. A few come to mind. I hate to call
names. No, you don't have to call any names. That's all right.
Yeah, I think if you've measured it out, there's probably more iron repair couplings than there is PVC pipe on the
well,
line.
You know what? You say that nonchalantly, but tell the audience why that's bad. What's the problem with having a bunch of repair stuff? I mean, I kind of have an idea, but not being an expert, I bet you're going to teach me something right now. So what is the problem with having that, you know, so many repair couplings as opposed to just replacing an entire stretch of pipe? Water or sewer?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the repair couplings themselves are an issue, but just the overall lack of reliability of the line. You know, it's a constant sort of headache of, you know, that sometime in the very near future, you're going to have to dedicate a fair amount of man hours, oftentimes in the middle of the night, to repairing this line.
Mm-hmm. So that means it's just, once you see so many along the same stretch, it's just time to replace the whole thing.
Sure. I think that's usually the case.
Do you have some, and if they're bad, I don't want you to name the cities because I certainly don't want to embarrass anybody, but I just know they're out there from conversations with folks like you, so folks from Consolidated, but also at the Rural Water Association meetings, you hear, you know, stories, engineers talk about, well, I had to go help out this city because they waited until they got, you know, some kind of EPD, you know, restrictions put on them before they, and then they just had to fix it. But do you have some examples of what happens when the infrastructure is overlooked? And, you know, it doesn't have to be one particular kind. I mean, there's all kinds of infrastructure categories.
But, oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Sure you've got some.
Most of my experience comes in with a lack of inventory of repair fittings. And there's those problems that, like we just talked about, you know, old lines that are prone to breakages if there's a pressure spike and maybe the city is unable to keep an adequate amount of repair fittings to cover what they need. You know, we, as a company and as a branch and as an employee, we're very dedicated to servicing our customers. So we're here when you call us, whether it's the middle of the night or, you know, noon on a weekday. So there's a lot of days, you know, I think it was my second date with my wife. We pulled up to a movie theater and we walked into the theater and I saw my phone light up. And I was at that crossroads where I knew I should probably reject the call, but I took the call and I said, you know, I've got to go. We've got to go to the office and get something. And we left. And, you know, that's a part of this industry. But
so that was in the evening, but what did the, don't identify the caller or the city name, but what did they need? Was it kind of an emergency thing?
Or? It was an emergency thing. It was a force main that was broken. Uh-huh. And they needed some, if I remember right, it was 10-inch repair fittings.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and picked those up at the office and took them to the city.
Delivered them
to the utility.
Yeah,
and then
they needed that bad.
Yeah, we came back for some coffee or something. Who knows?
Did you say you were dating your wife at the time?
I think it was our second date.
Second date.
Yeah.
And she still married you.
Still married me.
Turned out okay.
Going on 7 years.
And I'm sure the city was appreciative that you were able to come out. They were appreciative that you answered the call, even though you're out on a date.
Sure, sure.
Well, I tell you what, that's the dedication I couldn't have possibly put into a commercial advertisement. Well, that can't be the only story you have about something that's happened, or where you either had to come in and save the day, or a funny story about something going on in utilities. A lot of these things, people don't know. They just know they either have water or the toilet flushes or it doesn't. And the backstory is something you're going to have a unique perspective on.
So. Sure. There's rarely a phone call to say, thank you, Mr. Public Works guy, for this tap turning on.
It's a thankless job. Nobody knows that they actually exist until something is gone wrong and they're jumping in to actually take care of it.
I don't have water. You need to get to work.
Exactly. So you got to have some other stories about stuff that's going on in some of your customers.
Yeah, there was a time, and it's been several years ago now, we sold some products for a tap. And it was a small town again. And this particular small town, they had not done many hot taps. And if you're familiar with a hot tap, it's where you...
Most of the people listening probably need to know exactly what a tap is and then the difference between that and a hot tap.
So if you have an existing water main and you need to create an outlet for a water service, you would do
a
hot tap.
To go to a house or a business.
Right. Okay. So you would attach a saddle to the main and under pressure install a valve and drill a hole, a hot tap. This customer needed to do this, but they didn't really know how to do it, honestly. So I grabbed a saddle and the other parts that they needed, took it down, and it was a somewhat busy day, so I brought the material down. They had exposed the pipe. I helped them install it and sort of tighten things up and got them going. And I said, okay, guys, just call me if you need something else. So about an hour later, I get a call, and he said, hey, the valve that you shipped us, it's no good. It was a little confusing because it's a pretty basic ball valve. If it's not physically broken in your hand, obviously broken, and it's good. So
okay.
Anyway, I said, well, I'll be there as soon as I can. I think it was going to be a few hours, and I'd be back to check it out. Well, I never heard anything. About an hour later, a friend of mine called, and he's a contractor, and he was passing that job site. And he said, hey, man, have you talked to the city of blank? And I said, actually, I did. I talked to him, and I was there, and I sold him some things, and they actually had a valve that was, they said, was messed up. I said, well, I'm out here now, and they have blown sewer water all over a parking lot.
What?
I said, the parking lot's covered in it.
Oh.
I said, well, that's kind of strange. So as it turned out, they had mistakenly tapped a sewer force main instead of a water main.
Oh.
And the valve, they didn't have pressure because the pumps were off. So they left.
And the pumps came back.
The pumps kicked on. So I called the guy after that, say another hour later. Said, hey, whatever happened with that valve? And he said, oh, we figured it out. and we never spoke about it again.
So they were supposed to be getting something from that main line to go towards the house, but they tapped into main line of things you don't want to go
Correct.
Towards the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it ended up going all over a parking lot.
That's right.
I'm sure that was quite a mess. I'm glad not to know
the
city.
Yeah, it was quite a mess.
So, Matt, how long have you been with Consolidated now?
Going on 13 years.
Okay. So in all those years, and you and I have talked enough, you seem to really enjoy what you do.
I do.
I enjoy talking to you because you, like I already mentioned, you have a broad range of perspectives you can draw from because you deal with so many different customers. Not all municipal governments, but it seems to be the predominant customer for you.
Sure.
And the cities vary in size. Just speak to what it's like to work with those guys because, you know, they're kind of unsung heroes. Like we said, nobody even thinks about guys that work in a public works or utilities department in the city until something goes wrong. And then those guys, they just, you know, well, all the days it's working just fine. Nobody
right.
thinks about it or makes sure to say, hey, thanks. There were no issues. There haven't been issues in weeks, you know,
yeah.
like that. But,
yeah.
But just talk about your job and the people you get to work with.
Yeah, so I do... I'd say the majority of my business is municipal, and a lot of that is small town. I think I gravitate more towards small towns. I mean, I'm from a small town, and I have so much more, I don't want to say more respect, but I have a lot of respect for the small town constraints of the public works department and what they have to deal with. And you know, in many cases, they have just as many tasks as a large city. It may be, you know, per person, per capita, I mean, they have a lot to do. And generally, they have a less amount of labor, at least talented labor, and they're feet are to the fire most of the time. And I have a lot of respect for that. Those guys work more often than not. It's a 7-day-a-week job, very often late nights, early mornings. You know, whether it's 105 degree heat in the summertime or, you know, 30 degree winters, they're out in the middle of the night fixing a water leak. And it's routine. And I see it, you know, day in, day out. I know I'm sort of repeating myself and saying that I have a lot of respect over and over. And I don't want it to sound patronizing because it isn't. But a lot of these small town public works directors and public works employees really drive me to work harder. I see what they do and what they do it with, and it makes me work a lot harder in my career to better serve them. Because I think as a branch, we all like to chase big contracts and big things, but I think small town Georgia is really at the core of what we do as a company, in my opinion.
It would be important to point out, you know, I'm sure you've got a lot more stories than the second date with your future wife getting a phone call. But every time you get a phone call after hours, the person on the other line has already been out there probably a couple hours before they figure out what they need and that they don't have it and that they need to call you for it. So when you're coming in to kind of be the hero to them because you're doing that, they've already been out there for a while, and there's usually not just one person waiting on you. It's probably a whole crew of people, and they're dealing with the problem and cutting things off and dealing with people, you know, yelling about not having water at, you know, 8, 9 at night, midnight, whatever time it is. So
yeah, where I may have a 2 or 3 hour detour, most of them and their crews just don't sleep that night.
Right,
they don't
go
home because they go back to it the next morning.
Show up the next morning and do all the other things that need to get done.
Yep, absolutely.
What are you seeing, again, your perspective, and I'll actually focus this one on small towns. What are you seeing as the biggest challenges with small towns because of those kind of your resource-strapped situations?
I think it is just aging infrastructure. We see a lot of small towns that this mountain of, you know, repair and need has built over the last 20, 30 years, you know, since the late 70s, early 80s, and now it really is quite an issue. And I think for some towns, it's they have some economic growth, and it's a little easier to sort of break off pieces and take care of it. But for some, it's overwhelming.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thanks for hanging out with us and talk a little bit about infrastructure, sharing stories. I'm glad it worked out with the girl you're on the date with so many years later. And I want to thank you. Matt was the driving force behind Consolidated Pipe and Supply Company becoming a season sponsor. So I just want to, Matt, thanks for what you've done. And I can tell when he says he really appreciates and respects small towns and the people in it, I can tell you it's genuine because we have conversations without microphones and recording equipment in front of us where he's saying the same thing. So thank you, and thanks to Consolidated for sponsoring, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I'm proud that we've been able to sponsor your podcast. I'm a fan of it. I have been, you know, at least a season before that. It's given me some, you know, I normally deal with public works employees and directors and maybe city managers, but I rarely have any direct connection to council and mayor, and it's given me a lot of insight to the, you know, amount of work and time and energy that goes into that role. It's really impressive. No, I'm a fan of the podcast, and I'm proud to be here, and thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Matt.
While Matt Floyd and Consolidated Pipe supply many small towns with equipment and supplies to maintain their own infrastructure, I found someone else who works for a company that actually assists with or handles all of the maintenance operations of infrastructure systems for municipalities of any size, which might be especially helpful for small towns who have a difficult time doing it themselves.
Hi, I'm Charles Hano. I'm the Director of Municipal Operations for EOM Operations.
So I like to get to know my guests because in a small town, people want to know, you know, where are you from? What do your folks do? So where are you from?
I don't think it's a small town anymore, but I'm from Bainbridge, Georgia.
Okay.
Decatur County, class of 99, Bainbridge Bearcats. I grew up there since I was 6 years old. My parents owned a small hotel, and just small town life.
Okay. Graduated high school. What after that?
Went off to college, Mercy University. Went on to Savannah, got a master's here in Savannah, and working on my doctorate in Valdosta State.
Well, very cool. And how long you been with EOM?
This is my 5th year going on to my 6th.
Well, tell us a little bit about EOM, because you guys are very much in, we're talking about infrastructure, so you're very much into more the operations side, but kind of a wide variety of things you seem to offer. We're going to talk about that. So, yeah, give us kind of the history of the company and what you guys do.
Our owner, Stanley Hurd and Melissa Hurd, started in 1999 in business here in Richmond Hill, and it was an electrical contracting business. From there, they started creating basic systems of how to track jobs, cost jobs, general organization. And from there, they started creating and adding divisions where needed. Concrete cutting and coring, because to run conduit, you have to go through walls. And it was just more efficient to rely on himself, kind of a very Henry Ford mentality. But, you know, over time, they started adding things that they thought could help the business model. And when Stanley started noticing that, you know, public works could be made more efficient through his systems and processes, this was a reasonable leap for us. I was lucky enough to sign on in 2014, and it's just been a wonderful opportunity to grow. Here in Richmond Hill, we do a full scope operations that, like we do in many other places, but in our smaller towns, oftentimes it's just smaller services. We are capable of doing everything from wastewater operations, water operations, streets operations, stormwater maintenance, fleet maintenance. For our smaller clients, Midway, Sylvania, Springfield, we're doing, you know, kind of what they need. Not every city wants to turn over everything.
Right.
And not every city has all of those components.
Right.
We really take a lot of pride in being able to help them in their specific needs.
All right. So you started that talking about starting out with electrical work and electrical contracting, and we've gone, there was quite an evolution in there of the things that got taken on over the years since the late 90s. So just describe that. How did that all come to be?
You know, it's starting with small jobs and growing into bigger and bigger jobs. And as those types of jobs go, he found himself installing larger infrastructure. You know, lift stations are highly electrical components, high voltage. And, you know, he was getting involved with a lot of jobs like that. Here in Richmond Hill, a lot of them out of the Ford plantation were installed by him. And that was the natural progression of his first introduction into these systems and understanding how they worked, the components, what it took to run them, operate them, install them. And then it was kind of fortuitous because where his office was right next to the public works office where the water and sewer crew used to work out of.
Okay.
And he would tell me his story. He'd sit out, he'd walk out there with his cup of coffee and he'd be able to see them. And he always thought, gosh, in my system, that wouldn't fly. You know, there's just too many people. There's too much lag time. There's not enough efficiency. It's just got too much lull. You can't have guys standing around for that much just in case stuff happens. There's got to be a better way to do this. And that's where he always said that's where his thought to, well, I know how to do lift stations, how to wire wells. Now it's just operating them. I already have the systems. Well, let's bridge those two worlds and see what we can do with it.
You already had a lot of the components, and it was just about putting those things together.
Basically. But with all these other divisions, the concrete division, the response division, and the electrical guys, we had a huge workforce to pull from as well. So that's where the lags go away. When you can plan your work and have enough work where you can cross-train people effectively, you can take those lulls out. You don't have a unitasker doing one job. You have a guy that when he's done with his job, he can go help the other guy with his job.
Right.
And that's a big part of how his approach is on job sites and how he built his business.
So you didn't start so much in the municipal operations as a company, but now you're there in a big way. You're titled Director of Municipal Operations, right? So
that wasn't always the case.
Right.
I started out as his collection system and water distribution system manager at one project. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, as I learned more about the business side of it, as I built better relationships with city leaders and became more of a liaison between the city and the operations field staff, it was a good fit, and I'm very fortunate that he relied on me to expand my role, and I was glad to do it.
So it seems like EOM does a lot more than, but obviously municipal operations has grown, so where does that fit in kind of the scope of things, the size of the company and how much of it is on municipal operations now?
Well, you know, almost all of it's municipal operations. There's some function of it, you know, whether it's making water or doing an MS4 permit inspection for your stormwater system or helping repair police cars. These are all municipal functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's really it. It's an all-encompassing managerial role, just to say that I help my managers manage some of these components.
Okay. So we're talking about infrastructure. We did an episode of Small Town Podcast in the last season and kind of talked about some trying to introduce some new concepts to the public. But you have a unique perspective since you've dealt with so many different cities, both large and small, and you're dealing with so many different aspects of it, not just water and wastewater, but other parts of municipal operations. But with infrastructure, what are some of your observations? There's all this talk, it goes all the way up to the federal government, you know, infrastructure bill, we got to do something about this aging and dilapidated infrastructure. What are some of the key things that that you think that people should know? Maybe they don't.
Well, I agree. Everybody knows infrastructure is dilapidating. But I think what gets missed a lot is that through the entire life cycle of anything, whether it's a pump, install is such a minor cost in the grand scheme of that item's life. So when you talk about as a pump wears down, it's got a 20-year life cycle. Well, for the last 15 years of that cycle, if that pump is a worn impeller and it's completely worn out, its wear rings are gone, and it's completely running inefficiently, and it's running 2-3 times harder than it's supposed to, you're talking exponential costs over the initial install capital investment. So I think that's the thing that gets missed most often.
People. Just from running more than it should? What do you mean?
I'll give you a great example. Yeah. Here in Richmond Hill, I know it's not a small town, it's a medium-sized town. But
that's right, it used to be a small town.
It used to be. This is an example that always sits on me, and our council can attest to it. Lift stations oftentimes are influenced by stormwater. You have places in the system where stormwater can get in, and you're essentially pumping it to your wastewater plant.
I and I.
That is correct.
That's right. We learned that in the
infiltration and inflow
from Chad Griffin from Stillwater's Engineering. He taught us about I&I last year.
Well, I&I is a big problem. And just on the one half of town on Highway 17, we had a couple of lift stations that had severe run times. We noticed that every single rain event, these pumps would run all day. And with just a basic kind of look through the stormwater system and the wastewater system, we discovered, oh, well, it's a series of 8 leaking manhole lids that are in the invert of a ditch, and they're taking on water every single time it rains. Okay, that's an easy fix. We'll go and we'll seal those up. That problem was solved. That whole little quadrant of town wasn't leaking anymore, and that station would cut on and cycle on and off during rain events. No problem.
So just to give kind of a scope, you said it was running, you know, 24 hours after a rain. So then when it cut down, how many hours is it supposed to run in an average day?
A couple hours.
Two, okay. That's quite a reduction.
It is. But then what we noticed, because we had lift stations pump from one to another. They receive flow via gravity, and then they pump it up to another area, which may flow from gravity or to another station. We noticed that from that station, the next couple stations had a lot of runtime, and we immediately thought, oh, well, we'll solve that problem, and those two will solve themselves. And that wasn't the case. They still had high run times. That one station didn't, but the couple downstream from it still had high run times. So then it's, okay, now what do? We went and looked, and okay, there are no manholes and inverts of ditches. What do we do next? What we discovered, and it's just when a rain event happens, being proactive, opening manhole lids, looking at where your water is coming from, seeing what direction you're getting heavy flow of clear water, and going that direction, popping manholes. And then lo and behold, we found one needle in the haystack. We found it at the edge of a what you would call a swampy bottom that had a hole inside of it that no one knew about. And every time it would rain, the swamp would fill up, and it would drain right into that little hole of the one manhole.
Steady leak.
Huh. And that would explain why those were having such severe run times for much longer. So we fixed it. And what I ended up showing my council is at our main lift station, as well as our smaller regional lift stations, we had almost a 300% reduction during rain events, pump cycles.
Just from fixing those things. Yeah.
So if you think about the cost of infrastructure, the installs, it's the tip of the iceberg.
But that's the thing that a lot of people focus on, because I'll tell you, as a mayor of a small town, when it's time to do that, boy, that, you know, one pump at one lift station for us, we're talking between $50,000 and $70,000, depending on the brand, the model, all that kind of
but
stuff.
But if you think about over the course of a year, if you save $1,000 or $2,000 at one lift station, over the course of 12 months, you may not notice that on that one billing cycle.
Right.
But if you look at that one station over 12 months and it's, wow, that was a grand, that was $2,000, you know, and then you multiply that by 48, 49 stations.
Right.
You're starting to talk about real money then.
Yeah.
And now you're talking 1 year. Let's go into a 5-year cycle of we prevented that. Mm-hmm. And now you're talking a lot of money that can be reallocated for something else.
Is that an example of, I mean, it sounds like it's an example we're focusing on the wrong things. Yeah, the install stuff, let's go as cheap as we can, but a lot more of the money savings would be in, because you just described what seems like fairly simple fixes. Yes, it took some time to find where the water was coming in, the INI.
Sure.
But once you stop that, which was fairly simple, that's a lot of savings.
It is, and it's not just finding those things. You know, it's servicing pumps as they should. You know, they wear just like anything else. They're pumping gritty stuff that wears impellers out. If you're not checking that, if you're just looking at run times, you're not going to see that. Mm-hmm. You're really not. Your run times are going to slowly get longer and longer and longer. And a lot of times, it's sad to say, operators that aren't having that proactive thought process, I mean, they're probably just looking at things going, oh, yeah, that thing always runs during a major rain event, instead of asking the question, why?
Why?
Exactly, but it happens more often than you believe.
Well, that's an interesting example right there. What's some of the other observations you've got in your time working with so many different cities?
Oh, my gosh. Just general maintenance. I won't name the city.
No, don't do that if it's bad.
I went to a lift station and checked it, and the pump was in such bad shape that it couldn't even keep up with the flow of the station. It was full three-quarters to the top, and it just ran, not intermittently. It ran all the time. At some point, that pump, before I got there, it may have been another week, it may have been 2 weeks, it may have been another month of just constantly running, but that pump at some point would have stopped. Mm-hmm. And when it stopped, there would have been a spill, guaranteed.
And that would have been bad.
That would have been
because
bad.
Because the stuff you're messing with there is not what you want to have spilled.
Mm-hmm. And it was a combination. The pump was completely worn and shot. I believe we ended up rebuilding the whole lower half of that pump for them, as well as the other pump, because it wasn't running at all. When I showed up there that day, I reversed the pump and got some of the debris that was stuck in it out, and it pumped a little bit better. Mm-hmm. It still sounded like a broken jet engine taking off, but it was. I got it to pump down that day. We immediately began repair, and within 2 weeks, the whole, at least mechanical portion of that station was completely redone.
Now, I'm used to asking questions because there's a lot of small towns that are not growing, and they're in rural areas. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious. Let me throw this at you for communities that are, you named Richmond Hill and Bainbridge, places that used to be considered small towns, and now they're above my 10,000 population mark. Do you see things in communities where there is some growth, but maybe the growth of that infrastructure is not being managed right, and that leads to problems down the road?
I mean, it's easy enough to get excited about growth, and before you know it, you've got 8 subdivisions being serviced by a lift station that's undersized, and then it's just a process of staying ahead of it. You have to be prepared with infrastructure before development, but that's sometimes if the development's there, you want to get that underway, and then you negotiate infrastructure later. And I've seen that where, I mean, it makes sense. I get it. You don't want to tell the developer, no, we're not going to develop this because we're on a 5-year cycle of helping build this out and having these 2 lift stations in place to handle it. You go toward development with an eye toward upgrading your current infrastructure. But that absolutely happens where you have larger stations receiving a lot of flow pumping to a regional station that may be smaller, that can't handle that flow, that's struggling all the time. So then it's helping a city get from point A to B of this is what you need to do, and this is how we're going to get there.
It's easy to get excited about some growth and some
sure
development.
It is.
And sometimes that infrastructure is not part of the plan. It's just, hey, we're growing. That's great.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's led to some things.
And it's not so much even residential. You start getting industrial users
right.
in the
oh,
mix.
Yeah.
And now you're talking about jobs. There are a lot of ramifications that politically and socially from a community standpoint are important. So it's weaving through all those things just to help cities we work with get from point A to B. I mean, a perfect example, recently working with Sylvania, they've got a new chicken processing plant that's going to be providing great jobs for the area. We've been helping them out with their pretreatment permit, trying to make sure that aside from making sure that the plant is going to be in line with the future goals of the city and their new permit they're going to be getting, it's also making sure that we're not leaving them exposed to liability in terms of a treatment standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So it's balancing those things, making sure that they're meeting their customers' needs, but also helping us meet our customers' needs.
So in general, if you could speak to, because now our audience has grown over the last year and a half, but we mm-hmm. still have a lot of mayors and council members that listen to Small Town Podcasts. So if you could speak directly to them, what advice would you offer to local government leaders like me? Because, you know, the day I swore in to become the mayor of Osceola, I didn't automatically know anything about, you know, water systems and wastewater systems. So a lot of times the people making those decisions, we need to learn. So here's an opportunity to get some advice from someone that's an expert.
Sit down with the people that work in the field. You know, We recommend it to all of the council members, new incoming council members. We sit down with new council members, and I'll sit down with them for hours discussing their system specifically. Whatever city it is, if they want, we'll sit down. I'll explain, this is how many wells you have. This is how many lift stations you have. This is how the system works. This is what you need to be thinking of over the next 5 years, and this is why you need to be thinking about it. We do these things all the time, and I believe that. Any new incoming council member or even a seasoned one that just may not know as much, just go out in the field. Actually go to a well, go to a lift station, understand how it works. That way when someone's talking about it, you understand, hey, why do they have to replace floats? Oh, well, I know what the floats do now, you know? So that would probably be my advice.
If you can nail it down, what's the single most important thing that you'd want a council member to know with regard to infrastructure that maybe is just overlooked or just not paid enough attention to? I know, I'm putting you on the spot there.
Being mindful of the life cycle.
Okay.
Everything has a life cycle, whether it's storm pipe or sewer pipe, water pipe, pumps. They all have an expected use. So organizing that is, I think, very important, understanding where you're at in that life cycle so you can plan those things out and stagger them. So when you're getting your funding from wherever it's coming from, you can start planning that, going, hey, you know what, that pump, we're going to need to buy one within the next 5 years. And you keep that in the back of your mind.
I was going to say, everything has a life cycle, and we as elected officials always want it to be longer than it actually is.
Exactly.
So if a city of any size was interested in seeing how they could work with EOM, how EOM might be able to improve the efficiency of municipal operations, and you got a bunch of different categories of municipal mm-hmm. operations you can help with, how would they go about doing that?
I mean, it usually starts with a meeting with either a county manager or city manager, and it usually starts off as just a basic assessment. Flat rate, very low number, very manageable, depending on what they want. And oftentimes it's, you know, where are we at? They want a snapshot of what's going on in the system, because they could ask their guys, how's everything? And the answer they get is, oh, we're great, man. Because, you know, it would be awkward for a field guy to just sit down and give a whole breakdown of the four lift station problems he had that week to the city. It's just, you know, so they don't always get that information. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a couple of our clients, Effingham, Springfield, they've both done these assessments. And, well, I'll use for an example Springfield. What I did is I went into every single lift station, because that was specifically what that city manager wanted to know. What is the status of my lift stations? So I went to every single one, took pictures of issues and concerns. I wrote it all up in a bound report, basically told them, these are your problems at every single station. This is what needs to happen to get it back into 100% working order. And this would be kind of the approximate cost of what these things would be, just so you could understand. And if you want a priority list, if you did anything at this station, I'd want you to do this, if not everything. And, you know, we start from there. Generally from that, they start building confidence in what we're providing them. And it can spiral out. Sometimes people want compliance help. They've had maybe had issues with something as simple as making a consumer confidence report every year. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and they get violations based off of those things. So it could be something as easy as that. It could be something as easy as doing a water audit. As I'm a water loss auditor. So I've gone into cities, and the only thing we've done with those cities is I've done a water audit for them. And we'll do something as small as that. But that's how those relationships get started. You know, you're in front of them, you build trust, and the scope of services starts to grow from there. And then you go from consulting, helping with compliance, to, well, we have a few fire hydrants that need to be replaced. Mm-hmm. Can you guys do that? So
sure.
We went from consulting to now providing more maybe an advanced consulting, actual boots on the ground help with compliance, no real employees yet, to, okay, we're going to show up and help your guys install 9 fire hydrants for your ISO inspection. It just goes from there. And then ultimately the last step is, well, this has worked out really great. Can you guys give us a price on actually just taking it over altogether? And that's where we become really competitive, using all of our resources, all of our labor that we can do to create that efficiency we were talking about earlier. And usually it's a price that's too good to pass up.
Now, I know you're not the only ones that do this, so let me just ask this and just give you a chance to kind of, I don't know, talk about your company a little more. What do you think sets EOM apart from, and I don't want you to name any other competitors, but there are other companies that do this kind of thing. So what do you think makes EOM different?
Just the way we utilize our labor. A lot of projects, and I've worked for other private companies. I've worked for municipalities. I've worked for private companies. And I've seen the business model that almost all other private companies use, and it's very project specific. The project sustains itself. So you have a project where the profit's made on that project, resources are allocated only on that project. So at some point, you run into this bottleneck of if you generally need six guys in your water department, worst case scenario, but 9 times out of 10, you can get by with 4, they're going to keep 6 on staff, and they're going to try everything they can to find and make up that margin. And generally, that is in the form of an out-of-scope type service. And that's where they make the majority of their profit. Us, it's a 180-degree different approach. We utilize all of our available resources, and we ebb and flow that labor. So if I only need 4 guys, that's all that's there. When I need 6, I've got 6. But when I don't need 6, those other 2 are doing something else that's benefiting us as a company as a whole within our workspace. And it could be across all different divisions. It could be in all across all different departments. And the way that we make money is by being efficient. We find the efficiency, we find our profit margin. We don't bill our client to death to get that profit margin. We insource almost everything, just short of a necessary function that we have to get a piece of machinery that isn't provided to us. That's an extremely justifiable out of scope. It's not even in scope because you don't even have the piece of equipment, you know, something like that. But beyond that, we insource almost every single thing we possibly can to show the client what we save them. I think that's where we're completely different than how our competitors do business.
Before we left Charles, we had a special announcement about something EOM was doing to partner with Small Town Podcast.
Well, Charles, as we wrap this up, I think now's the point in this episode. I'm pleased to announce that EOM is actually sponsoring the next 3 episodes of Small Town Podcast. We're going to be highlighting 3 towns that you already do business with. So that'll be Sylvania, Georgia, Springfield, Georgia, and Midway, Georgia. So first of all, thank you for the sponsorship, and look forward to kind of talking to them and highlighting some towns you're already partnering with.
Well, no, thank you. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity. Thank you for what you do. You know, small towns really hold a special place in our heart just because of them needing the help. You know, we get a lot of satisfaction aside from the money in helping just because we feel like the knowledge gaps that they have, we can provide and fill those, and we feel very fortunate to be able to work with those towns.
Well, thanks again for talking with us today, and thanks for your sponsorship of Small Town Podcast.
And thank you.
So now you know where we're going for the next 3 episodes of Small Town Podcast, the small towns of Sylvania, Springfield, and Midway, all near coastal Georgia. I hope you will all join us for those episodes as we talk with the mayors of those small towns. Well, small towners, that'll do it for this episode of Small Town Podcast. I want to thank all my guests, Becky Taylor, Angelina Panettiere, Matt Floyd, and Charles Hano, for talking infrastructure with me. As always, we express our sincere appreciation to our seasoned sponsors, the Georgia Municipal Association, Consolidated Pipe, Koch Industries, and the Southern Mercantile, for supporting us as we explore and share great small towns. I'll talk to you soon, and y'all are welcome to come to Osceola anytime.
Small Town Podcast is an Irwinomics production that tells the stories of America's great small towns. We release new episodes every other week, featuring small towns through stories of the people who live and lead there, and sometimes exploring issues that affect small towns everywhere. Our podcast episodes are made possible with editing assistance from Resonant Recordings, who also mixes and masters all of our episodes. You can subscribe to Small Town Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and the next episode will download while you sleep. You can also leave us a rating and review, which would help us reach new listeners. We would really appreciate it. Beyond our episodes, you can hang out with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also learn more about us and the towns we visit by stopping by our website, www.smalltownpodcast.com. We love to show you all the small towners out there, some great images from the small towns we visit, and let you know about the festivals and events you can participate in and the places you hear about on our podcast. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you real soon.
Stand adjourned.